Jimmy Dobb, Britain's last world champion. You're here at the World Supercross Championship. You used to do that too in America. What are your thoughts of Supercross firstly coming to the UK again?
I think it's awesome. I mean, I think Supercross is such a fantastic sport and what is very easy to show many different people. It's just a sad state that, you know, it should be travelling the world, and it's good that it is now. So hopefully everybody can get behind it, and it will move on, and like the more support they can get over the next few years, and it'll turn into something similar to what it is in America.
So we'll look back at your career briefly here. You were a kind of child prodigy really growing up. You and Paul Mallon were like level to everyone else in the UK. I think you were on a Kajiva in Grand Prix at 16 or something. How was that experience being that young and
It was quite funny, we were talking about it this week, and obviously the difference in bikes from a production bike to a factory bike was just insane back then. And like the races were 45 minutes plus two laps. I think my first Grand Prix, I think both races were 54 and 55 minutes, because it was a 3 minute lap and we just missed the just one of them. So it was just like, you can imagine, it's like, and then, but I was watching, is it Conan last week, and what he's doing, and I honestly believe in this day and age me and Paul would have been winning Grand Prix at 16 had we have had the setups that there is now.
You
and
mean
everything.
The bikes and the support team all
yes,
around you, training in Belgium and all that sort of stuff?
Not necessarily training in Belgium, I'm not a believer in that, you know what I mean? It's like you've got Jeffrey Erlings, who's like the fastest kid on the planet, so everybody thinks they have to live in Holland. He never rides in Holland, he's always France and everywhere else. It's but it's just how it is. But like I say, it's just one of them. But I honestly think how professional it is, and you know, I had no clue what to do, you know what I mean? It's like you had to race this duration of races, and it's like, how do you get from this to that?
Did you guess you were just riding on talent at that point?
Pretty much, and like you'd think, oh, I've got to go running for 45 minutes, but you don't realise of like, yeah, I've been on a 45 minute run, but what's the, you know, intensity and all the information that they have now and everything. It's just, it'd have been nice to be around now, you know what I mean? And it's like, because like I say, nobody beat us ever.
Yeah.
Everybody came, and it was only then, and it's, but it is what it is, but it's it'd have been nice.
So you transitioned then, you're riding 250 GPs in 92, and I think only a Yamaha before then, you moved to Kawasaki
90.
In 92?
I moved to 250s. I moved to 250s in 90. Yeah, I was 18.
And was that because of your size and height and stuff, or just the deal?
I just went that way. I'd won the, because I was the youngest ever British champion, which is crazy, I still am. The youngest ever British champion at 17, and I won the 125, then I won the 250 at 18 the following year, but I was in and I won my first moto in 1990 on a 250 as well.
So I've a old tape of 92 when you won your moto at Schwanenstadt in Austria. How was that? Did you feel you were starting to climb the ranks at that point and really believe you could run with Schmidt and those guys, or
I mean, again, I was still doing it all myself. I had nobody like, this is what you need to do, and so you were just trying to like learn as you went on, and it was like that was the sad state. So it's like, you know, it was, you were still like somewhat of an amateur rider trying to ride professionally.
Yeah,
and like I say, it wasn't until probably I got back from America. And probably a couple of years into that, 2000 is when I really found the pieces that I needed. I found the right mechanic, like trainer. Obviously, I'd gone to KTM. I found Kurt Gibbons, and he was the final piece of the puzzle that really started bringing everything together.
So I remember 92 as well. You were leading at Kalinchi, and your bike failed off that drop, and you were throwing your goggles and stuff in frustration. What do you remember of that day, and how annoying is it when a Coonan sort of had it recently? Would you experience it back then to lose a GP win?
I think there was a lot of stuff going to it, because I was on a production Kawasaki, and then Alec Wright swapped me and Paul out. We turned up in the weekends. You're riding
of
the factory
RGP
bike.
Week?
No, or a few weeks before before Germany, and he took Paul off the factory bike and put him on my production bike, and I went on his. Okay. And neither of us liked each other's because we like completely different bikes.
Oh, so the whole setup was...
Yeah.
You were riding his
So bike. I had to ride a factory bike for, like, it was Germany and England, Fox Hills.
Right.
And I was just, I'm like, I just want my bike back.
Yeah.
I used to, like, rev them and, like, where Paul was low RPM.
Yeah.
So that was that. So we did that. And where were we? And then the following week, we went to Clinchy.
Mm-hmm.
The first race, I got second. The second one, I was in about third or fourth and got a front flat. So obviously, I couldn't ride.
Yeah.
And I just remembered before the last one, I said to my family, I'm like, I'm going to win this one.
Right.
And I was just gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I had, after a few laps, I think I had about, it seemed like an 8-10 second lead.
It was about 8, so I can't quite remember the distance, but gone, like.
And I just went off that drop and it just went locked up on me, and it was just, and it was all the frustrations of that, where it...
So it was like, yeah, but it wasn't just that moment, it was everything building up to it?
Yeah, it was just everything, that it was just like, you know, just messing you around, and also it was a tiny part that they says, oh, are you not running that after the effect, you know what I mean? And you were supposed to run something different, and but anyway, so it wasn't one of my best moments, but on the other side of things, it was very frustrating.
So after that, you'd shown the promise in GPs that you had the ability. You then moved to America. Was that always a goal to go to America?
It was. I should have gone to America.
94, did you go
to be 94? Honest, I should have gone to America when I was 16.
Okay. To learn Supercross, from that side, or just
no? Because I had my Supercross tracks my whole life.
Oh, right, okay.
So at 15, 16, I was like, I'd do Supercrosses and I'd be on the same second as the top Americans.
Right, okay.
So, but then I'd not ridden Supercross though so long, and it was...
Right, okay.
I think it was about mid-November we had friends over. Dave Osterman, who used to run Chad Reed's team.
Yeah.
He was like, why don't you call Mitch? So I called Mitch, because I didn't have a deal.
Oh, you didn't have a deal?
No, I'd finished 10th in the world and stuff, and I didn't have a deal. So I called Mitch, and I just asked him, and I'm like, have you got anything? He says, give me a minute. And he called me back the next day, and he says, yeah, and it was $500 a race, and I could get bonuses. So,
and you'd no salary, it was just per race? That's
$500 per race.
And was money more then in America than what... A GP salary was, or how did it compare?
For the Americans, was yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So it was a horrendous deal. It was just.
Right, okay.
But I went over and broke my arm. Well, smashed my nuts at the NEC in December.
Oh, and over here, yeah.
Yeah, and had a 4-hour operation on them to fix them.
Right.
And then I went out to America, and first day on the Supercross track did exactly the same thing, and screwed up before a triple. Still went for it. Snapped my arm.
Well, I was on a 125, so you had the much margin for error.
No, so it wasn't good. So, but like I said, I went out there a boy and came back a man, and I learned quite a lot. So
you showed glimpses. You think you won a couple of races?
Yeah.
There,
I got second in the Supercross Championship, and I got offered deals because I got second in Supercross 125, me and Kevin Windham had a chance of winning it at the last round. There was a couple of points between us.
That was 96.
But then I got offered a few deals, like Nolene Yamaha offered me one and a couple of others, but then I'd actually met my wife when I came back for a week in like August time or something.
Right.
And I was like, you know what, I'm just going to go home. Mm-hmm. And I always had this thing that I wanted to win a world title.
Okay.
It was just so... So that's when I came back, and then...
So, your American experience, you had decent results, probably not what you felt your full potential, but you were good in Supercross for a British guy. You won races outdoors. You were with Jeremy McGrath, Jeff Emig, and those guys, with them. How was that whole experience?
No, it was great. Jeff's still one of my best friends today, and it's like... I was watching a clip popped up on thingy, and it was like... You know, like in 95, I was getting like thirds and fourths every race in the 250 outdoors. And I was leading one till the last straight, and Larry Brooks thought I was racing him and not lapping him. So he just took me straight out, and then Doug Henry just come up the inside of me.
Is that
and
high
passed
point
me
or somewhere? Yeah. Up a hill? Up, yeah. I remember watching that, yeah.
And he passed me like 100 metres before the finish. I was like so pissed. But he'd already held me up for a lap.
Right, okay.
And then it was just like, so yeah, it was one of the things.
So even in America and looking back at GPs at that point, it was like you were there, thereabouts, and on your day you could win a moto podium.
Yeah.
You could supercross indoors, GPs, outdoors. Yeah. It was a wee bit similar again when you come back to GPs for a couple of years.
Yeah. The thing is, I rode for Rob Hooper, and like Rob had a great little team, but he didn't really have a budget. You know,
was that any sort of factory Suzuki then, or was that all private?
All private. And I was on £12,500, and I had to pay everything. That was my salary, and I had to pay everything out.
Really?
Yeah.
All your travel.
And I got second in Supercross in America.
That's why.
Still, I don't think he didn't finish the Supercross, and he came back from getting a podium at a national and stuff like that, and he was on 250,000 and I was on 12 and a half. So it's a little bit different. So
when you moved to KTM, was that the game changer? The bike,
yeah,
team, the support,
yeah,
you mentioned,
well, Kirk Gibbons. It's the first time I had a factory ride, realistically.
Right, yes.
If you look before, I had a factory ride at Suzuki in America for Supercross and got second. Then I got a KTM and I finished second, first, fourth. But the fourth should have been, you know, was a bit cheated out of that one, but it is what it is. But yeah, so it's just, you know, factory teams are factory teams because of the budgets they have and everything. There's a big difference, you know. So
in the first year you had a battle with Langston.
Yeah.
The second year you dominated. Talk us through those 2 years and what you learnt battling with Grant, because he was young and cocky. It seemed pretty cocky, and you were the guy trying to be.
They weren't no cockier than a South African, is they? So and it was tough. You know, at the end of the day, he deserved to win. He put the.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's a lot, little pieces of the puzzle that, you know, we were told and his team was told you weren't allowed to change the bike.
Okay.
And so they were supposed to be the same bike, and it didn't feel that way at certain races. But so the season finished, we went testing, and Ari Nolte is their engine guy. He says, oh, have a go on Grant's bike. I'm like, there's no point.
This is the end of the season?
Yeah, when we were testing for the following year. He says, there's no point. They're the same. Maybe they're not. And I rode on in this south of France in this track, and he went onto the track and he went up and over a little thing, and I just gassed it. I'm like, you motherfucker. And that's the bike I raced on.
Was that one massively annoying towards your employers,
hugely,
you know, to then go into the next season with them?
Yeah it was huge. Just cause it, cool, I'll come and grab you. It was just huge. It was just, I raced that bike the following year. So what Grant rode in 2000, the bits that his mechanic had done, or the engine guy that wasn't supposed to do but did, that's what I raced and won the championship on. And I'm not saying I'd have beat Grant with that.
Because you were dominant the next year. Like, you broke your collarbone race 2 weeks later, and I think you broke another one and raced again really soon.
But the thing is also, I learned, my wife came to me probably September time and everything, and says, oh, you're not the same rider you used to be when I first met you.
Right.
So she met me when I first come back from America.
Okay.
You're not the same rider. I said, yeah, I am. Like, usual thing, like bravado.
Yeah.
So I went, it's when we had videotapes, went and put one in and I watched it. I'm like, I should try it. And then that's where I completely changed my training around and everything, and all the kids that I've helped, from Searle to Max a little bit, Conrad and everything, it's the same system I do, or I've helped with them in back in the day, and I completely changed it around, and then it made me, I was a much better racer than I was the year before.
And did you feel pressure the year you won it? Was there a relief when you finally won it, or was it joy? Because I hear different riders
like
saying different things.
The day it was quite funny, because the day I won, it was like somebody had popped a balloon.
Right.
Because I broke this one in France, in Sweden, raced 10 days, 2 weeks later, and got second in France.
Mm-hmm.
Following Wednesday, break this collarbone. something happens on the bike and I crash and break this collarbone, but I can't have this one plated. So I went to the mule thinking, can I ride? And then obviously I could, and I ended up winning the race. And then the worst race result I got all year was the day I won the championship, which I got fourth. That was my worst result.
Kildare, was that Kildare?
Yeah. So
you didn't need to finish at that point.
No, but it was just like, as soon as I'd gone across the line, I just think it was just, I was just like, really? Dead. I mean,
with the emotion and the intensity,
I was 29 years old. It's you know, I'd not had these opportunities of kids, and it's like you think one collarbone, I can still do it, and the next one, it's like, I don't think I'm going to be able to do this. Do you know what I mean? It's like going away from here. So it's I mean, that was them years, but it all worked out in the end, I suppose.
And moving to the 250 class, then, I was speaking to Gordon Crockett about it. He said he went to KTM because he thought it was going to be like the 125, but the engineers changed in the back room, and then he said your style was the opposite to his. Mm. He was low revs and you were high revs, and then the bike, there was two different people telling engineers two opposite things, and the whole season was difficult. What was your view of that first?
It was frustrating because, I mean, in hindsight, I should have stayed down and let him develop that thing and then probably gone there.
Yeah.
But I trusted so much in Kurt and everything that I'm like, yeah, let's go for it. I mean, that bike wasn't even made till November, and we were racing on it. And I mean, a friend of mine, Craig Elwell, he's like, he brought another bike one day to my practice track. He says, ride this. I'm like, what's the point riding a stock bike compared to my factory bike? He says, just ride it. I did one lap on it. I was 2 seconds a lap quicker, and I just didn't think I was moving. And it was just little things that they tried to make the engine. It was lighter than a 125.
Okay.
So the vibrations were insane. That's what done these fingers.
Oh, that's what done it.
And it's like, both me and Gordon, we went to the really small bars, rubber-mounted grips, the biggest, fattest grips we could.
To stop the vibration.
To try and stop the vibration and little things like this. But, you know, they completely changed now, KTM. They do a proper program where it's like, you know, we were developing it as we were going on, but it just, it probably need a few years development. Normally bikes will have a 4-year development process now, where ours had about a 4-week one before we were racing, so.
Yeah, that was, basically.
So it's not a negative on them, you know what I mean? It's just something they've learnt now, and it doesn't happen, and
it was just bad timing. It was just then.
It was like, I should have just waited another year just to see how it had gone, and then you could have potentially said, well, I'll go on the 4-stroke or something. But
how was it to end your career? You'd achieved being world champion. Was it difficult to stop doing something you'd done your whole life? Because a lot of guys seem to have that problem. Or were you happy with everything that had happened in your career and you could walk away?
That's one of the things I'm lucky with. It's like, it was the German Grand Prix, the second moto, and my the light switch just went off. So I was quite lucky. It's like, normally there was people just having big crashes around me, and I'm like, normally you're like, oh, I passed a few more people, and it's like, and I'm like, I don't want to be here. And the risk and reward just didn't add up. I was on a privateer bike, and coming from a factory team, I rode for RWJ. And I went testing in October, and I says, yeah, that's Brian Wright's brand new bike, Honda, 4-stroke. And I says, yeah, that's all right, it's a good start. And I'm like, no, that's it. And that was it.
Is that RWJ?
Yeah. And then when you look at KTM, that you'd have had probably 6 engines, different engines to try. And as much as me and Gordon was different, it kind of slowed it up a little bit, but it didn't stop them developing for Gordon and developing for me. It was what you wanted.
Yeah.
You know, like, Gordon, I think, had a completely different frame to me.
Okay.
Because I liked a shorter, I liked it turning tight, Gordon liked it. So there was many things like that, and it didn't stop.
And that was a 250 you were on, and that was that an RWJ 250? You're back to on your...
4-stroke, 250.
Bless you, cutie. Yeah. Riding those things.
Yeah, so, and it was just, realistically, if I'd have known, I should have just gone on 450. And it would have been, you just work on the suspension and stuff like that.
Yeah,
it was a struggle.
So you got out of that and you were an agent as what?
I went straight. I'd already started an agency with football and things in 2000.
Right.
So I'd already got that going, so it was just a natural progression. But then I went and worked at Wasserman. Because I'm dyslexic, so I'm not really good going into a classroom.
Yeah.
I'm much better to be going to an environment of actually doing and learning. And so that's what I did. I went and worked with Wasserman and learnt the trade there, and then and did that till like a few years ago.
And then I think you see in one of the Whiskey Throttle show you're doing stunt work.
That's what
I
do
now, yeah.
That's basically what I do now. And that, after with during the management, I headed up the Monster in Europe. I was head of sports marketing for Monster, so from Valentino Rossi and Formula One and Jenson Button to skateboarders, I was doing all them deals for them as well. So it was a good
it was quite
learning
the experience post racing that you've had, and most people wouldn't even get that, let alone the career you've had as well, you know. So.
So and then a good old friend of mine, Lee Morrison, who was he used to race motocross with us back as kids, and then his first year pro was 92. He was riding for Rob Hooper and he crashed and broke his neck, so he had to stop. And then he went into crashing for a living. But now he's like one of the best coordinators there is, and that's who we work for, him and another guy called Gary Powell, who's very big in the, his family have always done all the bonds and everything like that.
So there's big films you're working on, like global films?
So, doing all that.
So when you look back at your career, you're walking about today, and the first thing I'm thinking of is you're the last British world champion. Is there a pride in that? Did you, everything you worked for, you achieved that status and go?
I mean, it's good. It's kind of frustrating, you know. I did everything I possibly could to try and help, like Tommy Searle, to win it, and he came up short a few times. And you know, and like the other riders that I've had a bit of a help with to try and get them, because I mean, it's what, been 22 years this year.
Conrad was looking promising as well, or his talent.
And he was like living with us at the time and stuff. But it's just frustrating. I can't see anybody at motocross winning for quite a while
from the UK.
Because it's like, is it Billy, the young kid on the Kawasaki? He looks quite good, but is he 16 now? Or?
Yeah, around that, I think.
Yeah. He's not riding.
No, he's not even riding MX2, brother.
I was 15 when I got third in the British Championship.
Yeah,
I got special license, so you know, and it's not be all and end all. I think the thing of like, oh, if you're not doing it now at 16, you've got no chance. I don't think it's there, but I just look at the speed. You know, you look at the British Championship at the moment, and what is concerning is Elliot Banks Brown. He's been on the podium, and he's been retired for what, 2-3 years, and got a full-time job building houses. So I don't know. I've not been to the races or anything, so so you just don't know what the level is. But till the ACU get serious and get proper people around that know what they're doing, and you know, because that's what France have done, and every other federation. You know, every other federation. Look at Italy. Look at France. The amount of money they put in, and then they wonder why there's so many people winning. You know, and it's not as if I'm quite outspoken, but it's not as if the ACU ain't got the money to do it. So, but who knows? I'm happy to talk to anybody, but. And I'd love to help with the system how it is at the moment and everything. I think it's going to be tough.
What are your thoughts on MXGP as it is now, the level of Hurlings, Geiger, Renault, Prado and ever, all those guys at the minute, pretty high and pretty stacked, MX, the young guys coming through MX3?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of positives. I think the age group is the most stupid thing I've ever seen.
And you wouldn't adjust the rule, you would take it away.
Take it away. What you're gaining from it now?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If you want people to guarantee them to go to MX1 or MXGP, simply put a cap, salary cap. If you want to make the big money, that's where you need to go.
Yeah.
I just just, I don't see. Problem is, the young kids that are coming through, they'd still win. You know, Jeffrey was winning when he was 16.
Yeah.
Ken won when he was 16, 17. It's not going to stop.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. That's not going to stop anything. But what the other kids, they're not learning a racecraft of how to actually race.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by riding with the older guys. You know.
Yeah, I remember Carl Long talking about Michele Fanton when he was young coming up and the stuff, how hard he was to pass and that sort of thing, which I guess they don't have these days.
Yeah. But Fanton's, I don't think, ever won a Grand Prix.
Yeah.
So you're not stopping anybody.
Yeah.
So what you are doing, you're stopping people from earning a living that can't really ride a 450.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? There's a lot of people. Out of all the smaller kids, it's just Sewer that's come through and really seems like he's made it. All the rest of the guys.
Because the 450 is such a big bike now.
It's just, it's sad. It's like it's, some people just can't ride it. And it's like, so, oh, their careers have to stop because of it. So.
And the World Supercross has big prize money, America now too. Do you think there's a way to, I don't know, get a sponsor or something to give prize money? And MXGP, would that make a difference? Or where you are, or is the prize money, salaries more important than prize money to you?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's you wish they'd look after the privateers more. Because the factory guys, they're getting bonuses from the team, so they make another grand for winning a Grand Prix. I don't think it's going to make that much difference where it would for a privateer. So it'd be nice if they had a proper privateers prize fund. But you know, I understand they're spending a lot on TV, and it'd be nice if they spent a little bit more. And so I think Paul Malin's doing a great job, but having to do it all himself is a lot. You could do with someone in the booth.
Maybe you could go in too. You could rehash old stories.
I'm not sure I'm the right person, but But like I say, there's a lot of positives, and but I know there's always negatives, but I just look at, like, why is there so little riders on the line? And I just, it's something that really needs to be looked at. And then also, after the first few that are making huge money, the rest of them are barely breaking even, so.
That's the strange thing about motocross. Top heavy, you have to be the best to really make, you know, to be rocks on a level to make the money.
Yeah.
That's great, Jimmy. Thank you very much.
No worries.